Clean Air Act.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In the contentious debate over air pollution, everyone agrees on one thing. That is, since the passage of the Clean Air Act 25 years ago, the quality of air in this country has improved considerably. Defenders of the Clean Air Act say tough regulations and the threat of enforcement are the reasons behind the quality of air improvements. But the act is based on a messy compromise. Old power plants, the dirty ones everyone expected to be phased out, are not held to the same strict standards as new ones. And in exchange, only routine maintenance on those old plants is allowed. Any modification or redesign or improvement requires the owners of that plant to immediately install the latest pollution control technology. But now the Bush administration is proposing relaxing those rules, a change that would allow more modifications, perhaps a longer life for the old power plants. Bush's supporters say it's time to make a shift away from regulation and enforcement, that free market principles and voluntary compliance can also lead to cleaner air. So, Connection listeners, what's the best way to ensure cleaner air? Is it now time to give the Clean Air Act a free market makeover, or are regulation and enforcement really the only way to go? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us today on this topic are Scott Siegel. He is spokesman for the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council. That's an organization that has fought specifically for these changes to the Clean Air Act. We also have Eric Schaefer with us. He spent 5 years as director of the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Regulatory Enforcement until he resigned earlier this year, saying the Bush administration was not enforcing the law properly. He's currently director of the Environmental Integrity Project. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
I don't want to set really firm ground rules here, but I know from doing my homework that you can get so lost in the details of the rules and the regulations and the different acts and proposals and new source reviews and stuff like that. So I'll begin by making a plea to try and keep it as simple as possible for us, because I know you folks both know this inside out, and we're just trying to make sense of it. Maybe, Scott, I can get you to begin with an explanation as to why you think, or the industry thinks, these changes would be a good thing, not necessarily for the industry, but for the environment.
Sure. Essentially, you've got to start with the first principle, which is, what is pollution? Pollution is inefficiency. The more efficient your car operates, the better its gas mileage, the less its impact on the natural environment. The same principle holds true for an electric power plant. And unfortunately, when the new source review program, which is a clean air program, is interpreted to bring the full weight and authority of the Clean Air Act down on every single episode which would increase the efficiency of facilities or enhance the maintenance of facilities, you lessen the incentive to have an efficiently operating power plant or industrial facility. Doing so is directly at variance with pollution control.
So how does backing off on the regulations make them more efficient?
Well, no one's talking about backing off on the Clean Air Act. I want to be very clear about that. What causes plants to be cleaner is a number of market conditions, but also the fact that every plant has a permit that requires the plant to be protective of human health and the environment. And no one is suggesting that plants are in violation of their permits. The question is, can we remove the perverse incentive against efficiency improvements?
Eric Schaefer, let me hear from you. You have a long history of enforcement. Are there other ways of making this work, of keeping the air clean?
Well, sure. You can always improve regulations and draw brighter lines. The question is whether you're drawing a brighter line to basically eliminate the law, which is what we think the Bush administration is doing here, or whether you're providing clarity to the industry and letting them know what routine repair is, if that's what they really want to know. I think you set the issue up nicely when you explained the law as saying that you're allowed to make routine repairs to your plant, but if you make a major modification, you have to get a permit and you have to put on pollution controls. I just want to make one important point to clarify that requirement. you can do whatever you want to your plant under the law today unless you increase pollution. That's a really important distinction to make. You want to invest in energy efficiency? Go right ahead. You can do that. The law lets you do that. All it says is if you make a change to that plant and you do it in a way that pushes pollution up, then you have to come in and get a permit like everyone else and put on state-of-the-art pollution controls. That's the bargain that was struck with these older plants, and that's what the fight is over today.
Yeah, can I get you just to zero in a little closer, Eric, on the older plants? Because that's the nub of the disagreement here, isn't it? Nobody's talking about the efficiency of a new fuel oil burning electric generating facility. It's the ones that were built back in the 70s.
That's right.
And go ahead.
Say a little bit more about that. Let's go back to 1977 when the Clean Air Act first became law, and I'm going to try to live up to your challenge to keep it simple. But in essence, at the time, you know, Congress said, okay, if you build a new power plant after this date, after 1977, we want state-of-the-art pollution controls. We need to clean up the air. We want good pollution controls. The industry came in and said, okay, we'll live with that, but don't make us put those controls on plants that are already built, on the old ones. And some of these are built in the 40s and 50s and still operating today. Don't make us control those up to the modern standard because we're going to retire them soon. And we have testimony back then, 25 years ago, saying these plants are only going to last another 10 or 15 years.
Was there anything that specifically said the industry had to shut them down?
No, not at all. Congress came back and said, fine, you want to keep these plants, you can keep them and run them, and we'll consider them exempt from the Clean Air Act, but is where the law comes in. If you physically modify those plants, if you physically change them or change their method of operation in a way that increases pollution, and that second part is very
right.
important, you got to get a permit and put on controls. That was the deal. EPA has gone in to try to enforce those requirements. The industry doesn't like that. They've gone to the Bush administration and asked for a change in the law, and that's what got announced a couple of weeks ago.
So, Scott Siegel, do you see this as, looking back to the origins of the Act, as something that was supposed to put some of these aging plants out of business by 2002?
Well, a couple of responses. I mean, some of what Eric says strikes me a little bit as revisionist history. First of all, if you go back in time to 1977, the country was just recovering from the Arab oil embargo. Natural gas prices were so volatile that Jimmy Carter had forbidden the additional use of natural gas in industrial applications. And, of course, we were about a year shy of Three Mile Island and the problems that the nuclear power industry was having. The watchword in the Carter administration was coal is our ace in the hole. Conceptually, there was to be an expansion in coal capacity. And in fact, as we sit here today, 55% of U.S. electric generating capacity is coal. So I see a very different history for the New Source Review Program, 1977 to date. I'd further add that
just a clarification, if I can, Scott. Wasn't there an expectation back in the mid 70s that, for example, nuclear plants were going to put a lot of these coal burning plants out of business?
Well, by the latter part of the 1970s, we had already begun to realize that nuclear power was problematic in terms of its unit cost of production. We already knew that. And in fact, while there was an expectation that nuclear would have a larger chunk of the pie,
right.
there was a serious expectation on the part of Secretary of Energy Jim Schlesinger that coal would be the primary expansion area. And today, as we sit, 55% does come from coal. You'd almost get the impression that some folks in the public interest community just want to get rid of older coal-fired capacity. But I'd put it to you, I've never seen a new coal-fired plant that anybody in the environmental movement has ever supported the construction of. This leads me to a conclusion. They don't want old power plants. They don't want new power plants. They just don't want power plants. And coal-fired capacity is 55% of U.S. capacity. I think that's irresponsible.
Eric?
Yeah. Let me see how best to respond. First of all, you know, there's only so much time we can spend arguing over whose history is correct here.
Well, let's skip the history and just go to the last point that Scott was making about the environmental movement or public interest community, as he said it, wanting no coal-burning power plants, no power plants.
Yeah, I mean, whatever the environmental movement wants, the point is, plenty of power plants are being built today. Most of them, the new ones, natural gas, because they're cleaner and in many cases more economical than coal-fired power plants. But the battle isn't over whether to have coal or not to have coal. It's whether coal plants ought to be required to meet modern pollution control standards. One thing for your listeners to know is 2001, last year, we had a record increase in a number of power plants brought online. We had 48,000 megawatts of new power plant construction either completed or scheduled. It's the biggest year ever.
Gas, oil,
so
coal.
We're in the middle of a building boom in the power
90%
industry.
90% of that is gas-fired.
Okay, thanks.
And what's your point?
Well, I was just asking for the clarification.
No, I do have a point. My point is natural gas prices in an 18-month period have nearly tripled. We use natural gas in this country as feedstock for our consumer products and to heat homes. Particularly, think of New England for a moment. Fuel oil and natural gas are used to heat homes. Eric would like to channel that, I suppose, into electric power production. And if you fuel switch too much to natural gas, you rob natural gas by increasing its price substantially to those who can least afford to sustain that price increase, the people that are trying to heat their homes with natural gas. So there are trade-offs if we over-rely on natural gas.
No, I don't dispute that. I think the market can correct that problem if coal can compete. I think what we're talking about is putting all forms of power, whether it's natural gas or coal or fuel oil for that matter, on a level playing field where everybody has to meet the same emission control standards. And right now it's undeniable. If you've got a 50-year-old coal-fired power plant, you do not have to meet the same standard as somebody who builds a new power plant today. And that strikes me as an unlevel playing field. It discriminates against clean power, and it discriminates against new power plants that are, in fact, much more efficient than old ones.
Dick, let's focus on that word standard. You have to meet a higher standard. This reflects a fundamental confusion I'd like to clear up with your listeners. The New Source Review program is not a standard-setting program. The standards are set elsewhere in the Clean Air Act and are then reflected in the permits. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to vindicate the principle that they can increase the standards that plants have to meet, old and new. They can change. There can be permit modifications on down the line. That is protective of human health and the environment. You don't need this reinvention of the New Source Review program, which occurred in 1999, in order to stimulate emissions reductions. In fact, the principal emissions reductions associated with the Clean Air Act occurred well in advance of the 1998 and 1999 enforcement initiative that Eric is proud of.
Connection listeners, you have heard a little bit of the history of the debate that brings us to the point where we are right now. When we come back after the break, we want to look forward a little bit and talk about whether or not the ideas of voluntary compliance and market-driven efficiency are the smart way to go for in a push towards cleaner air and affordable power at the same time, or whether or not the Clean Air Act's history of using regulation and enforcement is the way that the Bush administration needs to continue to go. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Just a reminder to stay with WBUR for the latest on the weapons inspections in Iraq, including a special BBC Talking Point interview with Prime Minister Tony Blair at 2 o'clock.
8451.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Scott Siegel, spokesman for the Electric Reliability Coordination Council. It's a coalition of electric utilities, power companies, and other interest groups in the power industry. Eric Schaefer is also with us. He's director of the Environmental Integrity Project of the Rockefeller Family Fund. And what we're talking about is the proposed changes and the changes that have been brought forward by the Bush administration, what effect they will have on not so much the Clean Air Act, but the quality of air. Eric, let me start with you. Do you see, however we characterize what the changes are we talking about a fundamental change in the philosophical approach between regulators and polluters here?
I'm sorry, who is that for?
That's for Eric.
Okay. Yes, I think we are. I think that I can answer that on several different levels. We've got a law now, and I'm just going to read it. It's just the one sentence that matters. It says, any physical change in an existing facility which increases the amount of any pollutant must get a permit and put on pollution controls. That's from the statute. Pretty clear. Department of Justice has gone out to try to enforce that law and brought a number of lawsuits against big companies. Those are in court right now. I have never seen an administration in the middle of lawsuits that its own Justice Department has filed say we're essentially going to eliminate that requirement, which is what their new regulations would do.
And what I'm asking you is whether or not it's a fundamental philosophical change on the principle of enforcement and regulation.
It's certainly a philosophical change in the sense that you have enforcement underway and you have an administration that is saying we're going to stop essentially in midstream. I mean, technically they'll say, oh, we'll proceed with the cases, but what they're of course doing is changing the law the cases are based on. And I think that's unusual, to put it mildly. A second problem is this is the part of the law that gives communities control over whether or not the power plant in their neighborhood can expand or remodel in a way that increases pollution. It's a very important law that allows you to step in and say, law says you could do whatever you want to your plant until you increase emissions in my neighborhood, and that's when I get to object, and that's when I go to the permit authorities, and you have to, in fact, get a permit and come in and put on pollution controls. I think the administration is putting all its eggs in the market incentive and voluntary program basket, betting that that's going to produce good results, and skipping over the problem that it's going to leave local communities with, which is they now will no longer have the tools to turn to these plants and say, you know, you need to comply with the law. You can't just increase your pollution at will.
Scott, do you see this as a moment for the industry to step up to the plate and say, in fact, we can regulate ourselves as well as the government?
Actually, I don't agree with that characterization.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you why. Dick, I don't view this as a fundamental change in the way the law operates. In fact, it was then Vice President Al Gore, in his Reinventing Government reports, and Administrator Browner, who said that old-fashioned, old-style command and control, stick only, hit them as hard as you possibly can, adversarial enforcement regimes are not the best way to protect the environment. Saying that environmental protection correlates directly with the number of lawsuits you can file is a very outdated and outmoded way to view environmental protection. Rather, Vice President Gore, Environmental Defense, a major mainstream environmental organization, said there are better ways. We can still have enforceable caps, right? Actual governmental limitations on the amount of pollution. But within those caps, we can have a regime which allows those who know their facilities the best, those that own and operate the facilities, to make some decisions about the best way to achieve reductions. That is not a free market approach. When we talk about
it's a freer market approach, though,
isn't it? It is freer. It is a more rational approach. But when we talk about cap and trade, there's nothing free market about the word cap. Cap is an exercise of sovereignty, and it is a limitation. The question is, what's the best way to achieve the reduction?
If I could on that issue, the cap and trade program has helped in the last few years. We have one in place now to control the acid rain problem, and it's helped to reduce emissions overall. So it definitely has some value as a supplement to pollution control. The question is whether that's going to be our only mechanism. Here's what's happened under the acid rain law. We've gotten about a 33% reduction in the last 11 years since the Clean Air Act was last updated in 1990. In sulfur dioxide emissions nationwide, but some very large plants in some parts of the country, like western Pennsylvania, have actually increased their pollution over that same 11-year period. And again, I know it's tough for listeners to sort of follow this tennis match between Scott and myself, but just get online, go to the Clean Air Markets website at epa.gov, And you can look up your local power plant and find out whether its emissions have gone down or in fact increased. You'll find that about 40% of them have increased their emissions. We've got three plants in western Pennsylvania
that
increased their pollution by 80,000 tons over the last 11 years. That's what the market approach allows you to do. You have to decide whether those local increases are a good thing or a bad thing.
We've got a lot of people who want to join the program. Let's start first in South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Dana's on the line. Hi, Dana.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. I would like to say that the rhetoric of voluntary compliance is carte blanche for the industry to pollute. If industries really care about air pollution and being good so-called corporate citizens, why don't they just obey the law that gives the people control of their air and water? You know, they tried this in the past with the rhetoric of enlightened self-interest. We want to be, and that's just, you know, so when the tide turns and their self-interest is not compatible with public health standards or environmental standards, you know, the only thing that can stop them from polluting is government regulation. So this
whole argument that Scott's making, that if we're allowed to be more efficient, we are actually a cleaner industry, that doesn't wash with you, Dana?
Well, if they can make themselves more efficient as far as, you know, and stay in compliance with the law, yes, as long as there's a regulating body. Regulation is not coercion. I mean, if they want to show some personal initiative, amen to them, but there's still, the law should be there. I mean, just like there should be laws that prevent me from killing my neighbor, much as I might not like him or her, you know. There should be a law to prevent me from killing my neighbor. Well, it's the same thing. We should have laws, and they should be strict laws that...
And, Scott, they should be enforced. What about it?
Absolutely, they should be enforced. You know, the fact of the matter is, nobody is saying don't enforce the Clean Air Act. We support the Clean Air Act. Take, for example, the position of some of the major labor unions who actually make money by installing air pollution control equipment. All right? So they have a vested interest in strong enforcement of the Clean Air Act.
And some of the unions have a vested interest in the maintenance of old plants, and they argue against it. I mean,
that's a bit
of a mug's game to go down that road.
No, it's not. Let me draw the point, which is they have an incentive to install new equipment. They also have an incentive to maintain existing plants. That's the exact same motivation that you find in industry as well. There are efficiency upgrades that are being left on the shelf that could be made to make existing plants perform better. We're not talking about failing to enforce the Clean Air Act. We're talking about making the Clean Air Act more rational and making enforcement of the Clean Air Act more rational. I can't understand why anybody would believe that the best Clean Air Act is the one that is the least clear. And all that the Bush administration has attempted to do is add a measure of clarity to an existing new source review program. They've not attempted to repeal it or foreshorten it, but to make it more clear. I can't understand why anybody would say, you know, I've got an idea. Let's make the program as unclear as possible, and that'll reduce pollution.
Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin. Kevin's on the line. Kevin?
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks. I'd just like to bring up the concept of economic externalities, a basic supply and demand concept, wherein the supply and demand curve is affected by things that don't relate directly to price. And my comment...
Give me a specific example. What you're talking about in this case?
For instance, this case, the fact that, say, lumber companies get to buy vast tracts of land for very, very cheap so they can cheaply... process lumber, and then we get cheaper prices with wood, and when in fact no one, including the company, has to pay for the environmental cost of the product. So I guess my comment is, until companies are forced to pay for these economic, or to consider these economic externalities, which makes all of their products more expensive, for example, gas. Gasoline would be much higher priced, and in turn, them forcing those price hikes on us. How could we ever expect the free market to reflect or enforce pollution standards? Hopefully, that wasn't too confusing.
Well, I'm going to pass it to Scott with my sense of what you're saying, Kevin, and that is that unless there's an economic incentive to clean it up, then the industry doesn't do that. Isn't that what you're saying?
I think I understand what he's saying. I think what he's saying is until the price of coal, just as an example, reflects all the downside environmental consequences associated with coal use and production, then we won't have a legitimate market. I mean, I'm familiar with the argument. The problem with that is it's tempting to say that when coal is used in our society right now, that its externalities are not reflected. It's tempting, but it's wrong. There is a complex, comprehensive environmental regulatory regime in place that deals with coal, and it comes with tremendous expense. Hundreds of millions, billions of dollars spent on environmental improvements in the utility sector. And that's just the utilities, leaving alone the industrial sector. So those externalities are reflected. But there's a dark side to your caller's question. The dark side is this. People who live in poverty, who live at or near the poverty level, or who live on fixed incomes, pay 4 to 6 times the amount of money on their electricity bill as percentage of their monthly income than do people in the middle class and the upper middle class. So if you truly attempt to artificially stimulate the cost associated with fossil fuels, that cost goes very directly to those in our society who are least able to afford it. And I think that creates a potent social justice critique, frankly, of saying somehow we need to artificially stimulate our view of externalities in order to make coal as expensive as possible.
Eric, let me
get a very frightening result.
Yeah, can I get a quick word in on that? Let me try to make it a little bit simpler. If you build a new coal-fired power plant or any new power plant, you got to put on good pollution controls. If you run an old plant built in the 50s, you don't, and you do not have to meet the same standard. That's the law today. You get that exemption only until you take that old plant and change it in some way that increases pollution. That's when you have to pay the freight. That's when the bill comes due. So if you're talking about externalities, you don't, if you're running an old plant, face the same cost for cleaning up the environment and controlling pollution that you do if you build a new plant. And there's nothing fair about that. That's been running for 25 years, it's time to put an end to that loophole, not to look for ways to expand it. On this concern about social justice, which coming from utilities is always, I'm always a little skeptical, but here's what the Department of Energy said when they looked at the impact of requiring these old dinosaurs to meet modern pollution control requirements. In essence, in a report they issued in December of 2000, you can get it off the DOE website, they said, and I'm quoting here, the impact on electricity prices would be small because the cost of adding those emission controls generally do not increase the operating costs of the plants who now set the market price for power. So the average price of electricity isn't expected to increase by much. In other words, we have a competitive market. We have lots of new, clean power sources. If these old plants are forced to clean up, they're not going to be able to pass the costs on to consumers because we have a pretty robust marketplace right now. So that's good news for people who are paying the bills.
I know I'm not the first person to have observed that there's no such thing as a free lunch, but the idea to say that the net increase in cost for electric power production is modest, and at $70 billion, that's B with a billion with a B, that doesn't strike me as modest, but there are those... But the fact that you could not increase the unit cost of electricity production by that much, part of that is born in the fact that you have increased fuel switching to natural gas. And as we've already discussed, natural gas is incredibly volatile. When Eric says clean, you think natural gas, and that means shorting supply for consumer products and for home heating. And again, it's the same economic statistics. Those who can least afford it are impacted the
most.
But
Scott, isn't it also the case that if you're talking about an old power plant, that it could, even at an inefficient level, it may be more economically valuable to the company to continue running it because the capital costs disappeared 20, 30 years ago. And even if it's inefficient, it may be generating more revenue for the company simply because it's an old plant.
Well, the problem is if the full weight and authority of the Clean Air Act were to fall simultaneously on every power plant overnight, our belief and our statistics that we have garnered are that a number of the major coal-fired power plants, particularly in the Midwest and the Southeast, might make the economically rational decision not to continue operation.
No, I'm not talking about some great thunderbolt from the sky. I'm simply saying that it is in the interest of the industry, isn't it, to try and perpetuate those old plants?
Well, I got to tell you, what's interesting about your thunderbolt from the sky is when Eric talks about the benefits associated with new source review, he's assuming a thunderbolt from the sky. He's assuming that every facility to whom NSR could potentially be applied would automatically capitulate to the government's interpretation of the program, the enforcement officials' interpretation of the program. That's an unrealistic assumption, but that is the assumption we're dealt with, and so I think it's appropriate to take a look at what the downside consequences to that assumption are.
But Eric Schaefer, wasn't it the assumption, the implication of the original wording of the Clean Air Act, and don't take me into the legislation, but just your understanding of it, that by this time, by 2002, a lot of those plants would be out of business? That they would be replaced by nuclear power, or that they would have been replaced by new plants, that we wouldn't be having a conversation about perpetuating old coal-fired plants in this century.
Now, Dick, is that for me or
Yeah, it is, Eric.
Okay. I think that's right. And again, I'm reading a quote from a hearing back in 1975 from a utility industry representative. And essentially they said, actually, it is a direct quote, "It's imprudent to backfit pollution controls on existing plants, especially older units facing retirement within 10 to 15 years." That was 25 years ago. And you had that was 27 years ago. And you had the industry saying, these units are going to be gone in 10 to 15 years. Don't make us put controls on them because they're just not going to be around. And so I think it's pretty reasonable for Congress to have thought, all right, we're in a sort of phase-out period, and we'll let these units either be phased out, or if the industry wants to keep them around by physically upgrading them, then they have to put the pollution controls on.
Okay, Connection listeners, we do know that many of those plants are still around. What's the best way to assist, encourage, force the best quality air through working with, enforcing the industry? Your thoughts on that. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Blue Man Group at the Charles Playhouse.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. We're inviting you to join our conversation about clean air, clear skies, competing visions for how the power-producing industry produces power, air pollution. Let's go first to Anne, who's calling in from Cambridge. And Anne, you've got some involvement with this this area, am I right?
Yeah, I'm actually in Boston. This is Ann Weeks from the Clean Air Task Force. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Eric. You know my boss, Armin Cohen, I think. We are attorneys and provide legal and technical support to nonprofit groups around the country working on this very issue. And I guess I would like to take issue with Scott's characterization of the nonprofit community as basically obstructionist. I think that the point is not that gas is cleaner than coal, but that what we need for this country is cleaner air all around. We need it from power plants, we need it from cleaner vehicles, and I think it's true that the nonprofit community supports the cleanest possible energy production. I happen to have some clients who think that pretty damn clean energy production comes from integrated gasified combined cycle coal plants, which we would love if EPA would decide was the lowest achievable emission rate, was the standard for, say, the lowest achievable emission rate for the electric power industry. But I am guessing that Scott's clients would not be happy with that. I think it's think it's very easy to characterize us as obstructionist and use that and higher, potentially higher electricity prices, which I think we've all just heard are not necessarily the immediate response. But I think it's easy to use that to... I think it's easy to use that to cover over what's going on here, which is that the electric utility industry would like to continue to run dinosaurs without putting on controls.
But, Ann, what I'm interested in hearing from you is whether or not the shift away from enforcement and regulation, which is what we're talking about, can lead to the type of cleaner air that Scott's saying. You're saying that
that's
not...
I don't think we're shifting away from regulation. I think we're changing the way regulation happens, and we're trusting...
In a good way?
And we're trusting the utility industry to police itself.
And you don't think that'll work?
I don't.
Why?
What incentive do they have to police themselves? I'm an attorney. I happen to know that in the corporate world, the corporate manager has a responsibility to his shareholders to produce the greatest amount of profit for the shareholder. And if that means cutting a corner, if that means not voluntarily putting on power plant controls, if that means cutting a corner, then the manager has a fiduciary responsibility, in a sense, to do that if he sees a way of doing it. That's corporate law.
Okay, stay with me, Ann. I want to let Scott answer.
Nobody is talking about stopping the Clean Air Act or reversing its enforcement paradigm. No one is talking about that. What we are talking about is marrying the incentives that are created from enforcement programs with incentives that are created by greater rationality in the act, by allowing those that know the facility the best to make those decisions that will achieve the same shared goal that Ann and Eric might have for electric power production and for the amount of emissions coming from it. Look, there have been massive reductions in air emissions. Every criteria air pollutant has been reduced, 28% for CO, 39% for sulfur dioxide, 42% for volatile organic compounds.
Well, hang on a second, Scott. The point Ann is making is that the manager of the power plant's first responsibility is to the investors, not to the people who are downwind of the plant. And that's the sort of challenge that she's presenting you about the voluntary nature of this compliance.
Well, and I disagree with that. A, it is not a voluntary program. No one is suggesting a voluntary program. Voluntary programs are, as Ann characterizes them, one where there is little downside consequence if you do not participate. I assure you, if the program tomorrow became a cap-and-trade program for the Clean Air Act for all criteria air pollutants, there would be downside consequences for failure to participate. There would be enforcement. And so it's a red herring to just say this is volunteerism and folks run amok. People have legal obligations. They have legal obligations to produce reliable electricity that's in the charter of every electric utility. They have obligation to also be in compliance with the law, and that includes the environmental law. So they have a lot of balls in the air, but they try and keep them all up.
Last one to you, Ann.
I would like to make one more point, and that is that Scott characterizes the people who know the plants the best as the owners of the plants. I would like to point out that I think the people who know the plants the best tend to be the people who live within a one-mile radius of the plant, who experience the fallout, the particulate matter, the pollution. Those are the people who know the plant the best, not the owner who happens to live in another state. And I think that any change in the regulatory structure which takes away the ability of the people who live within the close vicinity, the region that's really impacted by the plant, the public health effects of the plant are felt. The closer you are to a plant, the heavier, the stronger the public health impact. I think that any regulatory change that takes away the ability of those people to know what's coming out of the stack, to enforce what's coming out of the stack, and puts the impetus or the responsibility on a foreign, foreign owner.
Okay, and I got your point. I want to move on. We've got a bunch of people. We're going to try and squeeze in as many as we can. 1-800-423-8255 to Medford, Massachusetts. Adam's on the line. Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning. First, I have to agree, voluntary compliance is ludicrous. I don't see the government promoting voluntary compliance with crime. But whether or not that's the issue, I have a question for both your guests. So far, the discussion has been, to me at least, very theoretical. And while I've enjoyed it, I'm one of those people who lives downwind from three or four grandfathered plants in Massachusetts, and I wondered if your guests could simply say, okay, let's talk about plant X, and have Eric say, here's what's possible under the current law, here's what's possible under the changes, and then Scott could rebut, just so we could really get it down into hard reality.
Okay, good idea. Eric, can you pick from your memory or from your experience one plant that stands as an example?
Sure, I'll take an easy one. We had a TVA plant where the plant operator went in, cut a 25-foot hole in the side of the boiler, built a monorail inside the plant, laid railroad tracks outside the plant, shut the unit down for 9 months, spent $57 million, and used 70 workers hauling large components out of the old boiler and replacing them with brand new parts. Now, TVA insists in court today that that's routine repair and that therefore that's exempt from the law. The government, the Justice Department, says otherwise. It says, come on, you got to be kidding me. That's basically overhauling the plant. No way that's routine repair. You're liable. You need to put pollution controls on. If the government wins, that plant has to reduce 90% of its sulfur dioxide pollution. It's got to put on state-of-the-art controls. It's no longer grandfathered. You're talking about tens of thousands of tons of sulfur dioxide being taken out of the air. I think the administration's rule changes would allow big modifications like that to be exempt from the law.
Well, the problem with picking a specific facility like that TVA facility and saying, well, this characterizes all routine maintenance, is that it's a logical fallacy. But in that particular case, though, remember, a power plant is a very, very large piece of industrial equipment. The burn box alone is large enough to put a small office building or the Statue of Liberty inside of it. These are very large facilities. Conceptually, to say, I know, we'll look at the size of the hole you have to make and determine if that's routine maintenance, that's silly. Large pieces of equipment need other large pieces of equipment in order to maintain them. Spending $57 million on a facility whose capital and operating cost is in excess of a half billion, begins to look more routine. So taking numbers in a vacuum, I think, is a very dangerous approach.
If I could just come back on that. Scott, you say you want a bright line. You want a bright line that tells you what's routine maintenance and what isn't. I think you know the facts in the TVA case, and you've read the administration's proposal. Would that administration proposal allow that plant to claim those changes as routine maintenance and therefore be exempt from the Clean Air Act provision that we're talking about? Yes or no?
Impossible to tell, because as you know, the administration
proposed... Well, where's the bright line then?
There isn't one, and that's one of my disagreements with the administration. They proposed a menu of options for the definition of routine maintenance.
Let me rephrase it then. Yeah. Do you think, as a matter of law, that kind of change should be exempt? Let's lay it on the table.
Well, I will say this. I don't know enough about the individual facts to make a judgment there, but I do think that a number of the lawsuits that your program at EPA filed stretched and contorted the understanding of the new source review program in such a way that made the program radically unclear and have provided a disincentive for efficiency improvements and emission control. So, I do think that if we could resolve those cases in a way which gave greater clarity, that we would all be better off from an environmental and an economic perspective.
We're nearing the end of the program, and I wonder if I can ask you both to give me your sense of what's required. Just from the perspective of creating cleaner air, Scott, if you had your wish list, what would be at the top of it?
The top of my wish list, and I got to start by chiding the administration a little bit for not taking the opportunity and proposing a routine maintenance rule that was a little bit clearer about what their position on routine maintenance is.
Fair enough. We understand there's lack of clarity there.
Yes. What I would prefer is a fundamental and fair legal principle that allows for efficiency upgrades and maintenance projects to proceed. On old plants, right, on old plants. And on new plants, of course, importantly, the new source review program does produce important environmental benefits. You heard me say it here. But most of those benefits are involved in pre-construction review of new plants, because that's the time when you can get the greatest bang for the buck in emissions reductions. So we're not really talking about the, we're talking about maintenance questions here. We're not talking about new plants. We're talking about the existing plants.
Okay, fair enough. Eric, to you.
Two out of every 3 tons of sulfur dioxide that get generated in this country come from old power plants. That stuff turns into fine particulate matter, gets into your lungs, causes heart disease, lung cancer, premature death. So we're talking about a real public health problem here. My solution would be take these old power plants that are still operating without modern pollution controls, give them 10 years to either clean up or close. We've got plenty of new, cleaner power options. If they can't make the standard, let them go out of business. That's a market solution to me. If they can make the standard, and I think, as you said earlier, some of them would choose to, let them operate. But time to comply with the Clean Air Act.
Is that unreasonable, Scott?
That's terribly unreasonable. And what it shows, it unmasks Eric's view of the new Source of View program. It's not just a court-driven program. It's not just a he would like to use it as a regulatory program, something for which it's never been intended. And I would further add that, you know, when Eric uses scare tactics regarding particulate matter, he knows that most particulate matter exposure is not attributable to power plant emissions, but comes from mobile sources and comes from indoor air pollution. That's where we get exposed to the majority of particulate matter exposure, which is of the greatest concern for human health.
Eric, just one more for you, and that is whether or not you think that in the years ahead or in the months ahead, this is going to be a matter which will be resolved or managed at a regulatory level, or whether or not it's possibly likely to end up in court. We know that 9 attorneys general in the Northeast are considering taking the EPA to court. Is that where it's going to be settled?
It's going to court, no question.
And so that will, in the long run, matter more than whatever is done at a regulatory level?
And that's where it's going to be sorted out. The disagreements are too stark and too fundamental to get resolved any other way.
Eric, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Eric Schaefer is director of the Environmental Integrity Project of the Rockefeller Family Fund. Scott Siegel, thanks for your time.
Thanks.
Scott is a spokesman for the Electric Reliability Coordination Council. Connection listeners, please feel free to continue the conversation on our line, online at our website. We're at theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Ari Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon.